Hello and welcome to episode 13, I think it is, of the RJM Classic Motorcycles podcast. Today we are going to be talking about threads, and we've also got to discuss a little change to our format as well. So let's jump right in to that. Basically, whereas before we've recorded a whole batch of six episodes and then I've procrastinated over getting everything edited for a while, we think we're just going to start doing this as and when we feel like it. I think in the long run, we'll probably end up churning out more as a result of it because it forces us to get something recorded and dealt with as soon as we've done it. And it also allows us to be a bit more topical and deal with listener feedback, of which we have a little bit today. We got a couple of iTunes reviews first, iTunes or Apple Podcasts or whatever they're calling it these days. Feel free to jump in if you have anything to add on any of this, Ray.
Thank you.
First, on 18th of July, we have a review from LM Portsmouth, which is entitled Clear Titles and On-Topic Discussion. It reads as follows. Thank you so much for these podcasts. They're incredibly useful and a pleasure to listen to. Thank you very much. I like best of all the discussions of particular subject areas relevant to classic motorcycles. I recently bought an older Norton and was looking for exactly this kind of knowledge. Please create more and please put up your earlier ones in a non-YouTube format via the podcast app on Apple devices. Yes, good point on that. Essentially, the place where we're hosting the podcasts wanted to start charging us for putting up a certain amount of bandwidth, content space, whatever. And Ray was like, yeah, let's do this. And I said, I've kind of goaded you into buying all this gear for the studio. I mean, the company paid for it, but you know what I mean. So I was kind of reluctant to go ahead and do that. But is it possibly safe to say that that will probably happen at some point?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, fair enough. We will, LM Portsmouth, we will look into it. We also have from someone who goes by the name Mr. Anderson Council. The title is A Real Classic Podcast, and it says, not only informative, but delivered with honesty and humour. A very enjoyable listen. Keep going. Thank you very much, Mr. Anderson Council.
God bless you, Governor.
If you do want to leave us a review or whatever, or a rating, you can do that on Apple Podcasts and whatnot, or send us an email as well, which somebody has done, whose name is Thomas, and he'd been in touch some while before when we'd done the first run of episodes and was in touch again recently. I say recently, I think this was in about mid-June. But only in preparation for podcasting again did I check the emails. So here it is. It says, hello, Rowan. I've been burning through your episodes that have been coming out. Still great content. Like I've said before, I don't own any old British bikes, but the info you guys share and the stories are always great. And I totally lost my place. Yes. How is the podcast being received? Hopefully well, and you keep pursuing it. For a future show, could you ask Ray why he dislikes two-strokes? I noticed that topic was not big with him before. I personally love them. Also, any and all of the stories and info on his classic racing days would be amazing. Here in the States, classic racing is growing fast and people can't seem to get enough of the old stories and feel of that atmosphere. Also, do you guys sell the RJM shirts? If so, where could I get one and possibly some stickers for my bike trailer? Thanks, Thomas. Well, thank you very much, Thomas. Lots to cover there. How are they being received? Well, we got some feedback today, and obviously more of that would be great. So please do that via the appropriate channels.
And it's a real encouragement as well, isn't it? Because obviously, you know, none of our, particularly on YouTube, none of our stuff is monetized. So it's not like we're doing it for personal gain. Rather to in some sense promote the business, but the fact that we get feedback like this actually makes you want to come in the studio and do more, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, I mean, one of the intentions was even if we didn't build up a big audience or anything, just having a link to this kind of thing on the website, the intention was it could, you know, put us over and above a bit of the competition because, as we've said before, there's only so much you can find out about a business from reading a website and looking at some pictures. So we thought it would be useful and also to share information to get this kind of stuff out there. Why do you dislike two-strokes, Ray?
I don't know that's entirely true. There are two-strokes I like. There are two-strokes I've got a history with. Obviously, Aerial Arrow is the one that I really do like. I think it's because they are usually associated with lightweight or ultra lightweight, and frankly, not very sought after or valuable motorcycles, and you know, that's fine if that is what somebody's budget runs to. But of course, from our business point of view, people gravitate towards that sort of machine because they are to some extent more easy to deal with at home by themselves or as a first soiree into classic motorcycle ownership. But there's no commercial opportunity for us, which is principally what we're looking at. I had one of the earlier Yamaha two-stroke twins for a long, long while. It was actually the predecessor to the RD200, the YCS5E, and I loved it to bits. It was new when I bought it. I would still have it now, but for the fact that obviously when I started taking pillion passengers on the back, frankly, it just wasn't man enough. It just wasn't big enough for it. If I'd have had at the time the money to have gone out and bought a YDS7 or 250, I'd probably still have it today. So, no, it's only the fact that we don't specialise them in them. There's no commercial opportunity for us by and large two strokes don't really enter the conversation very much.
Well, is it possibly fair to say as well that it wasn't really until Japanese stuff came along that the two-stroke was really taken seriously? I mean, if you think of prestigious British two-strokes, there is about the Aerial Arrow and the Aerial Leader, and I think that's about it. Everything else was, you know, sort of a Bantam or a Panther or anything with a Villiers engine in it, whereas you look at Japanese stuff like the RGV 250 and some of the things you've mentioned there, it's a proper grown-up motorcycle compared to a lot of what came before.
I think you might end up getting some hate mail from Scott owners. Just a
guess.
Well,
yes. Well, I think
they were an exception, but by and large, you're right.
Also, in that email, we have mentioned stuff about your classic racing days. I suppose that warrants another episode of its own, really.
Oh, well, I'm sure if I delve in the archives, I can come up with all sorts of other tales from days with the CRMC.
Yeah, something to bear in mind. Do we sell the RJM shirts? Well, we're doing a great job of plugging it today. I'm covering mine up in a hoodie and Ray's wearing a V-Vendetta t-shirt. No, we don't. It's kind of the sort of thing which I think you shouldn't really look into doing unless somebody's asked about it. And Thomas, now you've asked about it, so I think, yes, probably we'll look into it. Although we still have access to the logo. And I haven't even ironed this shirt. I don't know if we still have access to this logo, do we?
I've accepted that before we have even new workwear produced that the original artwork has got to be redrawn, and I've got a sufficiently large representation of it to enable somebody to redraw it for further use. And it's literally a question of, with all the other things we're doing, finding time to get around to it. But of course we did discuss this possibility of hooking up with T-shirt people in the same way as InfoWars and Mark Dyson, people like
that. All these controversial figures we follow on the internet. Yeah, I mean, there's a cafe press and there's services out there. We will definitely look into it. I replied to Thomas basically saying, sorry, I didn't mean to ignore you, etc., etc. He responded with, I said, is it okay if we read out your email on the show? He said, no worries, Rowan, I know you guys are busy. Feel free to read my email out. That would be great. One topic I was thinking you guys might discuss or dedicate a whole episode to in the future, if you felt it worthy, might be parts restoration, how you guys go about blasting, buffing, painting, etc., old parts during a restoration. I have no doubt you and your father's combined knowledge on the topic would give all of us listeners a helping hand dealing with all of our crusty bike projects. Thanks again, and great show, Thomas. Thanks again to you, Thomas, for saying such kind things. Yes, there's lots to talk about on that front for a future episode, isn't there? But basically blasting, buffing, painting, etc. Yeah, I mean, that essentially covers it. I suppose it's part knowing how things should have been done originally, part knowing how things should be done now, and part knowing what products and what other people's services to get involved.
Right? Well, and also knowing the limitations of what you can achieve at home. I mean, as an example of that, when it comes to machine polishing, you can, of course, buy DIY kits. So you can grit load small mops and the various soaps for polishing aluminium. But the problem is, if you're trying to do it with a conventional hand drill, it's not powerful enough. You can't generate the heat. And, of course, the soaps don't move around the work like they do with, you know, a big bench grinder. in the very early days when we entered that sort of field of, you know, restoration work in-house, I think we had about 3 attempts before we got a powerful enough bench grinder that would actually do the job.
Hmm. So we're probably not going to read out reviews and things of that all the time. I mean, particularly if it's just people being nice, as great as it is, and we do read them all and love them all, and as Ray says, it's great inspiration, great motivation. But particularly any questions, rjmpodcast@gmail.com is the place to send those, and I think you can pretty much guarantee that we'll read it out on the show and have a little discussion about it. Moving on to today's main topic, threads, if I didn't say it already. We've talked about threads already. He says, gesturing to his T-shirt for the audio listener.
Yeah, we have.
Threads of all kinds. Well done, Thomas, for being so on message. Let's approach this as we often do from the perspective of a modern owner who's recently getting into classic motorcycling.
Who will be thinking, OMG, what is occurring?
Well, because I suppose with more modern machines, one needs only to contend with metric, a thread form which we absolutely loathe. It does look so ugly.
It does, yes.
It's too coarse to be properly coarse. But, I don't know, and not fine enough to be fine in every sense of the word. Explain the first things you need to know. What are the different thread forms and what sort of years are they involved in? We had had a review from someone with a Commando. That's an interesting one to touch on particularly.
Well, obviously the sort of thread forms you're likely to encounter on any machine you may be working on, frankly, depends on when it was built. You start off in the very, very early days where, of course, most of the manufacturers, I think it's fair to say, were literally at that stage progressing from bicycles to motorcycles, and as a consequence, all the thread forms they were using were relevant to the cycle industry. Now, typically, that is CEI, Cycle Engineers Institute, cycle thread, it's often referred to as, and for the most part, it's 26 threads to the inch, regardless of the diameter of the bolt. And you say, well, surely as the sizes go up, you potentially lose a lot of strength because there's not the depth of thread that would be afforded by a smaller number of TPI. But of course, with the cycle industry, it was all about anti-vibration and trying to prevent the things from unwinding themselves, which obviously with motorcycles continued to be relevant. As you then move through to the more mainstream classic period, so in other words into the 60s, you then, for reasons of manufacturing expedient, get odd, strange threads creeping in, and while I think about it, obviously one of the strange anomalies you'll find is that normally the protocol on any given machine holds good until you get down as far as 3/16, and almost nobody uses a 3/16 size of the main thread forms that were used on the bike. They go to BA. So the moment you go to 3/16 diameter screw, you're into the BA. Now, I've never understood that, but it is what it is, and it's pretty universal. It's also worth remembering when you find strange, odd nuts and bolts, particularly nuts, and I'm thinking, for example, of things like the nuts that hold brake operating arms onto rear brake spindles, for example. They're still cycled, believe it or not, but there are a 20 TPI cycle, which is used on some of the bigger forms. So it's a minefield out there. You then get to 1968-69, and there was a concerted effort, certainly with BSA and Triumph, to go on to the unified, characterized by AF spanners, which, for those who don't know, is reference to the size across the flats. It's not American funny. And that was fine, but it was by no means complete. So again, no doubt because of manufacturing expedience, they would use up old stock they got in certain applications where they could. So it was by no means a universal reversion to Unified. The only exception to that, of course, being, and we come back to that subject again, the Arial Arrow, which was a completely clean sheet design from day one and is entirely UNF and UNC throughout.
Yeah, you mentioned UNC there, UNC being the course version, Unified Course rather than Unified Fine. Touching back to Cycle a second, you also had Whitworth, which was the Courser thread form.
Well, in fact, because of course you've got Cycle Engineers Institute, you've then got British Standard Fine and British Standard Whitworth, which is effectively the early course thread. And of course, again, some of Cycle appears to coincide with some of the BSF, particularly at quarter. So you've got 26 threads to the inch, both on quarter Whitworth, sorry, quarter BSF and quarter Cycle. But of course, what you don't know until you try putting the wrong nut on the wrong bolt, that actually, although it's 26 TPI, there's a pitch angle difference in the thread between 55 degrees and 60. And the same applies with the difference between UNC and Whitworth. Again, it's for by and large the same amount of threads to the inch, but there's a difference, again, in the pitch angle from 55 to 65 degrees. In the case of Whitworth and UNC, even the factories themselves used to cross these over and misuse them quite regularly.
Have we touched particularly on BSF yet? Because that was contemporaneous with Cycle and Whitworth. Ironically, BSF stood for British Standard Fine, yet it was coarser than Cycle.
Exactly. No, I mean, to be fair, you will find a goodly smattering of it. But again, particularly early on, most motorcycle stuff was Cycle, and the BSF was very much the car stroke other industry and didn't penetrate as much as you might have imagined until much later on with the motorcycle industry.
It's also worth pointing out, we were talking about a quarter and 3/16. That is the equivalent of, in metric terms, M8, M10, M6, M4, etc. It goes up in increments, goes from 3/16 to quarter to 5/16 to 3/8. And then beyond that to 7/16.
And that physically is the diameter of the bolt itself. It's got nothing to do with the head.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Or the length, of course.
Indeed. Oh, just while we're on that subject.
Yes.
I had somebody query with me once that they were looking through the parts list for their Triumph motorcycle and didn't know what thread form UH was. Because they always quote it after the length of the bolt in question. Of course, it's underhead.
Yeah. So that's your main thread forms. Very rarely do we have to deal with metric. Apart from every now and then, there's a machine that comes in where everything has been messed with. I remember an A10 that before anything else, I ended up just reaching for the metric spanners because that's what everything had been bastardized to.
And also, of course, the famous Harris Bonnie, which... you know, you went through the entire lifetime of the industry in one motorcycle, starting with all sorts of cycle threads and finishing with odd bits of metric, which of course were part and parcel of the European bought-in components.
I think the Norton Commando is a great example of one that contains varying thread forms, because it's a funny old thing, the Norton Commando, because it holds similarities with quite a lot of earlier Nortons, yet in some ways it's very modern, particularly for what it is for the time. Right to the late Commandos, you've still got a separate engine and gearbox, yet you've also got an electric start on it. And also it's mechanical ignition, not electronic ignition.
And so. Also your old-fashioned pre-unit engine and gearbox is now rubber-mounted.
yes, indeed.
A complete anachronism.
So oftentimes in Commando is a fairly good example. Some things are Cycle, some things are UNF. Last thing to touch on there is what are the types of spanners I need? I've bought a classic bike. I know it's this year. What spanners do I need?
Well, do you know, I have to admit to my absolute shame, at age 16 when I first got this restorable aerial leader, I ended up buying the wrong spanners. I just assumed everything British was going to be Whitworth spanners, and of course, the one bike which had no Whitworth components or no cycle or no BSF components on it was the Aerial Arrow, and I kept wondering why I was rounding the ends off bolts all the time.
Yeah, so if you've got anything that is pre-UNF, be it cycle, BSF, Whitworth, or whatever, what spanners do you need, Raymond?
Well, obviously, we called them back in the day Whitworth spanners, but they're BSF spanners, they're Whitworth spanners. Interestingly enough, of course, a Whitworth spanner or a BSF spanner will generally have two size descriptions on the one spanner or on the one jaw, because they give you it in British standard and in Whitworth.
Indeed. And of course, sorry, UNF, UNC, that kind of thing, you need AF spanners.
Yes, as I said, not American funny. It's a measurement across the flats.
Yes, American funny, we always used to joke about. Do you remember we had some while ago, someone in the shop went, "So tell me, what does AF stand for?" He wasn't trying to catch us out, he just didn't know. And we both immediately completely blanked for whatever reason and just went, "American funny, that's what we call it anyway." Okay, it's all very good. I've got some nuts and bolts here. I have no idea what threads they are. How, Raymond, I ask you, how do I go about identifying them?
Well, thread gauges are quite useful and quite inexpensive, which is a good start. It's not the whole of the story. Obviously, if you're, you know, wondering what thread form a bolt is and you've got two or three to try and narrow it down, if you've got nuts of all three, you can try them and see which one fits. Or if you've got taps and dies, you can check it that way.
And if you are using a thread gauge, it's a great example of utilizing modern technology. You can pretty much just Google whatever TPI you've got there, and then that should normally tell you what it is. The other way is simply offering up another bolt to it. As you can imagine, we need to keep a stock of pretty much everything we're going to come across. Even metric. We've got some very dusty drawers of metric fasteners that are rarely messed with. But hey, we do come across them. And for
if you remember back in the dim distant past, one of the things that helped us on our road to wider recognition was we used to do pre-packed small quantity fasteners at all the auto jumbles and shows and race meetings we went to. We had these two big boards that were full of you know, sort of packaged but retail quantities of all sorts of nuts and bolts that nobody else in the world stocked.
What I often find, rather than using thread gauges, is just go around to our stock of fasteners and just offer whatever the bolt up is to other bolts. And then if you think, okay, that looks the same, wind a nut on it, yep, all good. So we've talked largely in terms of nuts and bolts and things like that. But supposing you've got an internal thread, be it on a crankcase or whatever, that you've damaged or you found as damaged. I mean, obviously, it's 50, 60 years old. It's not uncommon. What the hell do you do? Let's speak in terms of a screw or a bolt initially, first, as a starting point, if you've got a damaged thread.
Well, and we do see a lot of them, not only damaged threads, but sheared off studs and all sorts of things. I mean, we had one recently, an A10, that for the last many years, the sump plate of which was only held on by two remaining studs.
Mm-hmm.
And that really would have been three strikes you're out, because, of course, if you sheared another one, there would only be one stud very inadequately holding the damn thing on. Now, interestingly, we see damage to this area on A10s, A65s and B25s and the like frequently. Because, of course, if you're servicing the bike regularly, that sump plate has to come off. And given that they're now 40, 50, 60 years old, those sump plates technically have been off a lot of times. So you do see a lot of damage in that area. And this is also where you find makeshift repairs that people have tried at home that involve usually drilling the hole to a larger size and invariably tapping it out with a metric tap. Now, you'll only get away with that so often, and we've seen those lugs that have been welded back on and failed. We've seen them broken off altogether and all sorts. And for us to look at just a damaged thread that just wants repairing is absolute heaven, yeah, because normally we're going in after some other spanner monkey has been there, usually not to good effect. So the main weapon in our arsenal in terms of, you know, let's say you've got a strip thread, you know, that is required to be in place to hold your sump plate on, is actually a thread repair insert. Now, there have been many of these over the years, and most people we will be familiar with helicoil. We don't use helicoil. We use a system called Recoil, which is actually an Australian product, and goes into absolutely minute detail in terms of thread coverage. I have yet to find a conventional thread of any ilk that they have not been able to provide a kit for. And obviously we don't buy direct. We go through a retailer of some description. In fact, one of the people that regularly keep Recoil kits now are Snap-on. Your Snap-on man has access to those. Now, again, you say, well, goodness me, why is it down to an Australian company to produce all these weird and wonderful thread forms that you know really can be of no relevance to them by and large? And of course, there's always an element of politics, right? And on this particular occasion, I have to say it's an interesting result of, for years and years and years, Australian protectionism as far as importation was concerned in the automotive trade. At one time, their import tax on automotive, on vehicles and automotive parts was 100%. Which meant everything was way overpriced, way too expensive, so that, for example, with vehicle repair, you would find, for example, I've known several panel beaters who've served time in Australia and then come back to Blighty, and their natural reaction is to repair everything because you couldn't afford to buy the new panels. Now, the upshot of that is all sorts of little industries built up around this situation to provide repairability where there generally wasn't any. And that is, at least I presume, how Recoil came about as a system. And I'm so grateful for it.
You touched on briefly about this A10 with the absent-ish sump plate studs.
They were there. There was just only half of them.
Exactly. Well,
and only half of them.
Indeed. Well, tell the rest of that story because it's one of those moments where I think, Raymond, you never cease to amaze me. When I think I've extrapolated all the information I think I need to from you, you go and pull off a blinder like that. So what did you do?
Well, to be fair, and I sort of attacked this job a little bit sooner than you had expected me to.
Well, you see, because we needed to lie the machine down on its side, ideally. And I'd said to Ray, I'll just have a little look into a safe way of doing this. And then so I did so and went, what do you think? And then you went, okay, and then you got on and did it.
Well, it was with a tricky little job like that, bearing in mind you can go from hero to zero or from hero to complete disaster in the blink of an eye.
Because that is a known weak point in the case.
It is, and you can snap one of those lugs off as easy as winking. And, you know, very often with that kind of job, I need time to think about it. I need time for me to be in the right frame of mind and to some extent need the planets to align as well. And I'd lain down by the side of this thing. Obviously there'd be no fuel tank on it. So before we, you know, put the tank back on from what we've been doing upper engine wise,
the oil tank was drained as well.
That's true.
Course of conducting an oil change anyway. So
it was an ideal time to experiment. And of course, as you'll imagine, as that's right underneath the bottom of the engine, there's no way you're going to do it without it being, you know, laid on its side or, you know, worst case scenario, engine out, which clearly we didn't want to do. And the customer didn't want us to do because the instruction was, if it looks like it's going to be a problem, leave it the way it is.
Yeah.
And I really couldn't, in all decency and all honesty, send him away with it still like that. It just, you know. So anyway, I've lain down by the side of it and, you know, I thought, well, okay, I think I'm in the right frame of mind to do this. And I imagine all my planets had lined up. And so basically what you do is drill out the broken bit of stud And do it carefully and do it in stages. And obviously you're trying to, by hand, line the drill up in the direction of travel perfectly, with the hope that you can just drill the stud out and hopefully be able to reclaim the original thread. I mean, obviously, you've got a fallback situation, because if it doesn't quite work out like that, then you can always drill oversize and put a thread insert. But both of these, it went like an absolute dream. Managed to capture both of the original threads, drill right down the middle of the studs, and all was well.
Indeed. And you didn't even have, in that situation, anything to use as a drilling guide. If you're, we've seen cylinder heads where the bolt screws that go into them are, as I believe you described it at the time, wavering like daffodils in the breeze.
Yeah, the conventional one that you really need to, and the issue very often is when the bolt is a long bolt and it passes through a long or a deep piece of casing before it then engages in the thread it needs to engage in, that's when you've got to be super accurate in terms of alignment. And the best example of that is the on Triumph unit and pre-unit twin rocker boxes. On the very extreme, there are quarter bolts that go right through the length of the or the depth of the rocker box and then bolt into the head. Now, because these are quarter, because they were very often quite fine threads, they're all stripped. They're almost all have been repaired from one at one time or another. But if you get even slightly out in terms of your drilling and your tapping angle, you can't get a bolt to penetrate into the thread because the thread is at a slightly different angle to the tube it's just passed through. In that situation, you can actually use the rocker box as a drilling guide and actually pass the drill through the rocker box with it bolted up to the head before you go into the thread in the head. Again, great care and caution needs to be exercised, but that's the way you do that. And as you say, on that particular job, I got no... It was literally, you know, fly by the seat of your pants. Mm-hmm. I hope you were about right. Visualize it. You could do no more. But in terms of daffodils in the wind, we had a famous case, and it was surrounded by a certain amount of amusement, shame, confusion as to how this could have arisen, and all sorts. And I'll tell you the story. I had a stalled restoration of a A10 Super Rocket brought to me. The motor had already been done. Now, all you need to know for the purposes of this story is that there are five fasteners which hold the inner and outer primary cover onto the side of the crankcases. Because those bolts go right through into the crankcases themselves and very often are replaced with inappropriate length bolts, and because just inside the crankcases the flywheels are whizzing round, or the crankshafts whizzing round, what tends to happen if those bolts are slightly too big, are slightly too long, the flywheel will strike them, flatten the end over, so that when you take them out, they take the bloody thread with it. This is so common an occurrence, or the results of it is so frequently found. Now, clearly at whatever establishment had rebuilt the engine, preparatory to the rest of the restoration of this bike, had probably got the apprentice to put in thread inserts. Now, he would not have known that these needed to be super, super accurate. And when I came to this engine to try and bolt the primary chain case, again, as we say, the difference in angles did look like daffodils in the breeze. Now, straight away, I've got a problem. I've got an engine that's already been built up, and I've got a complete inability to actually bolt the primary to it. And as it happened at the time, we were only renting Unit 3, and there was a subcontractor for another firm physically working in Unit 4 doing a body shell change, as I seem to remember, and it was either an MG Midget or a Triumph Spitfire or something like that. A very good friend of Michael, Tracy Thompson. I haven't seen him in years, but I do see him from time to time. Now, he's into his bikes as well. And I said, here, Trace, have a look at this. See what you make of this. And he said, well, he said, I can think of a solution to it. He said, but you won't like it. Go on then. So he said, well, your main problem, obviously, is not the two short ones that just live inside the primary that are typically lock wired together. It's the three that go right the way through the outer cover, the inner primary cover, the mounting plate, and into the crankcases. So he said, just those three you've got a problem with. So I said, absolutely right. He said, well, if you made up studs rather than using bolts and could arrive at a sort of sleeve nut that would take the place of the what would have been a screw head, you could actually mount the studs in and fix them in, probably with a little drop of Loctite or something, and then you could actually bend them and tweak them straight. And, I mean, in terms of supreme bodgery, it really was a theory to behold. And, you know, I said to him, I said, thanks, Trace, I really appreciate that. I said, and I'm going to put it in front of the customer. I said, but I'm grateful for the solution. I said, but do you know, if I'd come up with it, I'd have been ashamed of myself.
Before we touch on a couple more horror stories, one doesn't always have to thread insert things. Of course, there are other ways. If it's a bolt, you need to repair the thread on, although there's no reason why you can't replace a bolt, or sometimes there is, of course, but that's obviously the ideal solution. You can get what's called a button die, which is a little round metal thing that you can gently ease onto the bolt, going backwards and forwards, grease it up nicely. And I suppose the male equivalent of that is what's called a tap, which, again, Ray, as you can explain, well, you don't need to explain, I'll do it. You just ease gently into the thread, and oftentimes that can repair it if there is some nastiness.
Sorry, there was something just fermenting in my brain there.
Okay.
And there's various thread repair devices. We've got a few of our own, like the recoil plug thread saver.
Mm.
But I was it suddenly came into my mind was many years ago, and before I ran the business, I was just, you know, a hobbyist round the lock up garages, and a near neighbour who had, as I recall, an SS50 Honda, or it may have been the 200 with the similar cable-operated disc brake arrangement. I can't remember now. And he managed to screw that up on one occasion, and it gave me an opportunity to learn how that cable-operated disc brake and caliper work. But on this occasion, he managed to virtually put a new spark plug in sideways. He had got it so seriously cross-threaded. Fortunately, it hadn't penetrated far, and I really hadn't got any specialist equipment to hand. So I took a redundant spark plug and actually cut a slot down the length of the thread at an angle to allow it to be a thread cleaner.
Mm-hmm.
Just to get rid of the swarf as I tried to redirect this modified plug in straight rather than sideways as he'd done. The hope was that this slot in the thread would just act as a thread cleaner and pick up the debris, which it did.
Mm-hmm. I had a situation recently that was far more fortunate than a lot of the situations Ray is describing. One of the Allen-headed screws, or they were in the case of this anyway, I don't know if they should be originally, that holds the gearbox outer cover on, this was an Oilin Frame T120V. One of them, or two of them, the opposites are, now I don't remember if it's 2.25 or 2.75 inches UH. What does UH mean? Underhead. And as I'm winding it in, that familiar feeling, you're winding it in and it's getting tighter and tighter and tighter, and you're just coming up to where you want to be, and then suddenly it goes loose again.
It goes all rubbery.
So I'm thinking, oh, great, gearbox out, a cover off, gearbox in, a cover off. I'm going to have to start drilling into the crankcases. But I thought, no, there's one thing I can try first. And I know that there is a little bit more depth in those holes than the bolts penetrate and the screws penetrate. So, and I couldn't find in the drawer a bolt that was about 1/4 inch longer, but I could find a piece of studding that was about 1.5 meters long. So I got a couple of nuts on this and I started winding that into the crankcases just until it bottomed out, and that seemed perfect. So Ray was passing and I went, here, Ray, look at this. And he saw this massive bit of stud poking out of, it was all out of hand. And then you said, you fool, I've got some of the right Allen screws upstairs. I can go and find you one of those.
Well, I had it in preparation for two jobs. One, my A65 Cafe Racer project, and also a Rocket 3 motor that literally came as a collection of bits with no fasteners. I built myself quite a selection, more so than we would normally stock, of a whole range of quarter-year NC cap heads. So it just, I think you had to shorten them, but I had some that were had.
I didn't even have to shorten
them. Did you not? Okay, well.
They were literally a quarter of an inch longer, which was just right to pick up on some better thread further down, which is often worth trying.
Obviously, and, you know, easy, whilst the damaged thread is still there, the fact of the matter is if you can tighten it normally, then it's a perfectly acceptable repair until such time as the thing needs to come apart again and be done properly.
I mean, you probably wouldn't want to do it on anything more crucial, but this is simply holding the gearbox outer cover on, and there's about, you know, half a dozen or so other screws helping it do the job. And I guess it's about the right repair for the right job, really. Go on then. Let's have a couple more horror stories. What about on the T120 bobber we worked on recently with one of the very nasty threads in the primary drive? You remember that?
Yeah, it was one of the two back two screws, which from memory is 5/16. I mean, it had been just brutalized again, as I said. So often when we are dealing with damaged threads, we're not actually dealing with a straightforwardly damaged thread. We're also dealing with somebody's unsuccessful attempt to repair it. And this was definitely one of those. And in the finish, it was, you know, drill it, tap it out to a larger size, screw a bolt in there, grind it, saw it and grind it flush, and then literally drill and tap into that. Which is another method. It's a bit barbaric, but if you know, if it provides a durable repair that prevents, what else would you have done? Engine out, engine apart, crankcases off to T&L, blah de blah de blah. So, you know,
sometimes you gotta work with what you got.
Yep.
Okay, let's have one more story. Tell us about the first matchless G12 you worked on.
Oh,
you remember when we had the podcast meeting and you told me the story?
Oh.
And I said, I'm going to write as a note, Ray's first G12. Will that be sufficient?
And I probably said yes.
You did, well, I don't like to say.
Oh, goodness.
I think this was probably cylinder head related as well, from memory.
Oh, no, I'm with it. Sorry. I apologize for that momentary lapse.
Not at all. I need to take notes better is what we've learned from this.
Well, one of the things that is critical, absolutely critical with the AGS and matchless twins is the mounting. I'm talking engine internally here now, the mounting of the center main bearing web. Now, from memory, it's held in with six studs. And there's, if you talk to the old sweats about how to do these properly, and of course, bless their hearts, there's not many of them left, and the one I learnt it off is no longer with us. All of those studs need to be present. You need to assemble that half of the bottom end of the engine with the nuts not quite nipped, rotate the crankshaft, make sure everything's settled down and hunky-dory, and then nip them down. Well, this particular matchless G12 only had five good studs, and I really wasn't prepared to take a chance. It was the first time I'd done one of these bottom ends, and everything, if possible, needed to be absolutely cock on. So to compound the problem further, somebody tried drilling this broken stud out and snapped the bloody drill off in the hole. So, of course, you've got a problem where you're just not going to drill it out now. And I discovered that the only way I was going to deal with this by getting a little small diameter grinding stone, you know, out of a Dremel type kit, and just tediously grind away at the back of this drill, a broken off drill bit, with such care and with such an appropriate diameter stone that it wasn't going to suddenly grab hold of and orbit the side of the hole, because that would just make the bit that you'd already got access to bigger, which is not what we needed anyway. After several hours, and of course, as you're drilling through it, if you've ever looked at the cross section of a twist drill, it's like a little bow tie. And every time I pulled the tool out to see how far we got, there was still this hard, shiny metal bow tie still in the bottom of this hole. And you got no idea until you get to the very tip of the drill that you're actually there. There could still be, you know, half an inch of bloody drill in there for all you know, theoretically. And I just got the sense that we were almost at the bottom of this drill and just saw the butterfly getting, or the bow tie getting slightly smaller, and just flicked the tip of the drill out with a probe and we were in. So that, again, was another one of those that, you know, I was determined to do properly because it warranted doing properly.
Just to round things off, Ray, what can you tell us about easy outs?
Oh, go away, go away. Horrible things.
He says blowing the microphone.
Yeah, sorry. No, I destroyed, again, sort of age 17 or 18, playing with my own equipment. So, you know, customers can be assured that I've learnt my lesson. Ruined my first A65 head. Now, one of the things you commonly find with A65s where you've got this little oil feed union that lives in the very back center of the cylinder head is they can break, they can shear off and leave a sheared off flush stud with the hole up the middle for the oil in the back of the cylinder head. And I thought, well, that's fair enough. I've seen these easy outs. That seems like a good idea to me. And it looks a bit like a tap, except it's got a reverse twist on it and it's made of hardened metal. And the idea is you wind it into the hole. I mean, obviously, if it's a stud, you have to make the hole first. As this was effectively an oil pipe fitting, there was already a hole there. Wind the easy out in and just wind the broken union out until it goes snap, and you now find you've got a hardened piece of metal right in the middle of this union. And, of course, then you try drilling round it, and then the drill doesn't quite go where you thought it was, and as a consequence, I was left with a requirement for a new cylinder head. Of course, back then, they were plentiful, and frankly, the head on this particular project wasn't all that brilliant anyway, and it did give me the opportunity to upgrade to twin carburetors, but I wouldn't like to try and persuade a client of that, nor would I need to now.
Still, silver lining, twin carb head.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. Well, I think that largely wraps things up. Obviously, you know, hopefully this has been helpful. Obviously, we've seen all manner of dreadful thread repairs, and if this stops one or two people from being guilty of that, then...
Oh, yeah. If in doubt, leave it to somebody who knows what they're doing.
Or, to put it another way, fools rush in where angels fear to thread. Well, that is all from us this week.
Sorry if we've rambled a bit.
Nah, come on. I hope it all made sense. There's a lot to take in there. Obviously, you can like and subscribe on YouTube. You can subscribe to us on iTunes or Apple Podcasts or whatever it's called to leave us a review. You can email us, rjmpodcast@gmail.com, or check out the website, rjmclassic.com. Thank you very much.
Bye.